Okay, where are we at? Well, when you begin either engaging in biblical justice, we begin with Jesus. And we started off talking about Jesus's, do we remember? Works. Do I really need to threaten you by having somebody come up here and write this for me? Do I need to do that? No, we won't do that yet. Yet. We will do it eventually. We split that into what? Words and deeds. And the words and deeds of Jesus, the works of Jesus, come together to reveal Jesus's identity. In last class, we talked about Matthew's gospel. And in Matthew's gospel, Jesus' identity is revealed as he's king. Obviously, we talked about in his words, he's talking about kingdom all the time, and it would naturally then follow that if you have a kingdom, then there should be a king. None of this matters until we get to Jesus' accomplishments. I had somebody, not in this class, but somebody last week, challenge my chart. They said, I don't understand why you don't make these a part of this. Because technically, those are the accomplishments, are deeds. And I said, but in my mind, there is no way that these three elements are on the same level as eating with sinners. It's just not the same. There's no way that you can convince me that these three elements are the same as healing a leper. It's just categorically different. It's like these three are clearly on steroids if I'm comparing them. It's just not even close. And I think these three are doing more than what these are doing. I think they're just in a different category. And these three are, I keep referring to them, but I haven't written them. What are they? Cross. Resurrection. Ascension. Yeah. And that ultimately then defines our identity. And that then leads to our works. Our works. And if I was being fancy with my chiasm, you would notice what the tip of the arrow is. That's where we at. That's where we are at. That's where we're headed. And today we are diving into Mark's gospel. We looked at Matthew's last time, but now I want to ask about Mark's gospel. In Mark's gospel, where is the genealogy? It is a trick question. There isn't one. Why? What are genealogies for? Remember last class we talked about how genealogies have two primary functions. What are they? Number one, it's inheritance. And number two, it traces the hand of God. So without a genealogy, then am I going to argue that Mark's gospel doesn't care about the hand of God? I am on some sense saying, arguing, that genealogies can point to the identity of Jesus. So without a genealogy in Mark, what does it point to about the identity of Jesus? What is it suggesting on some level? Go. So maybe on some level it's exalting his identity. Maybe he has a heavenly genealogy and it's not worthy of making the pages in Mark's gospel. That's a possible theory. What else? In the ancient world, who didn't really have or celebrate genealogies? Gentiles did. That's a good guess, though. That's a good guess. What else? Slaves, poor people. Why? Why would they not have a genealogy? No. Because there's no inheritance. What are you tracing? The shame that's in your family? Yeah, I'm going to be inherited from the slave of a slave of a slave of a slave. I inherited the chains. That's what you're going to trace in genealogy? No. In the ancient world, a genealogy for a slave or a servant didn't really mean much. Because there was nothing to inherit. There's nothing ultimately for them to claim except for more shame and more debt. Honestly, a lot of them are probably like, I'd rather just forget about my genealogy. In the same ways, I guess some of them could even say, in the same ways that the gods have forgotten about me. Just forget about it. You only had a genealogy whenever you were receiving something, usually of value. Which is one of the reasons why in Matthew's gospel it is so odd that Jesus' genealogy even contains some of the shameful elements of his story. We talked about how he points out that it was Uzziah's wife. Doesn't even say her name, but it makes sure it brings up the person that was wronged, lied to, and murdered, his wife, Bathsheba. That's very shameful, very odd. But in the ancient world, a slave, not only would they hide from their shame, they had nothing to inherit. They had nothing to claim. And if you're wanting to trace the hand of God, it's a bit more difficult to celebrate as a servant under subjugation of someone else. Watching God's hand move you generation by generation into more and more poverty. Therefore, without a genealogy, on some level, what can we say Mark's gospel is indicating about Jesus' identity? He is what? He's a slave. He's a servant. What's interesting about the pace of Mark's gospel, there's several different things I want to bring out, elements of Mark's gospel. First of them is the pace. My goodness, the first 11 chapters, first 10 chapters, as you know, we are cruising through Mark's gospel. Immediately. As a matter of fact, that word euthus is used 36 times in the first 10 chapters. Immediately he did this. And then it is used 6 times in the last 6 chapters. Because Mark's gospel slows way down. As a matter of fact, what's interesting is the first 10 chapters covers about 3 years of Jesus' life. Why? Why do I say 3 years? Well, we don't even have a birth narrative. He's just like, I got things to talk about. He was born. We get it. Move on. He jumps right into John the Baptist, and then 3 years and 10 chapters. And then we get about a week in the last 6 chapters. Half the book focuses on 1 week. Half the book focuses on 1 week. And we don't even get most of the ending. The way he resurrects, the women, they're like, oh my goodness, they're so afraid, and they leave. And that's how it ends. We don't get an ascension. We don't get post-resurrection appearances in Mark's gospel. What about verses 9 through 20? Take Christ in the Bible. That's all I can say. Okay? You guys know the issue with 9 through 20? Okay, I'm not going to go into the debate that. Some of you said no. Okay. I'll get there eventually. Okay. The whole point is, he's moving very quickly until about halfway through. And what's interesting is halfway through, right when he begins to slow down, right at the transition point, is a very important verse, especially in the history of our school. Mark 10:45, about halfway through, you see this, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." You see what I mean? See what's happening? The linchpin verse around which the entire Gospel of Mark transitions is one that emphasizes what about Jesus' identity? He's a servant. He's a slave to all. And you, when you think about that verse and you ponder just for a moment, the Son of Man, the one that through whom all things were created and for whom all things were created and by whom all things were created, the creator of the universe, came down here, and he chose what? If anybody had a claim on being served, hey, I deserve to be served, I would think it's the creator of the world in flesh. And yet he comes to the earth, and he chooses to be served. No, to not be served, but to serve. There's got to be a how much more there. You know what I mean? If the creator of the universe came down here and chose not to be served but to serve, even give his life as a ransom for many to set people free, how much more should we who aren't even the creators of the universe? Now, in some of our minds, we are the center of our universe. But that's kind of the problem. This is actually, and I say this every time I come to this text, but it's true. This is the text. Every wedding I do, it's from this text. I don't go to 1 Corinthians 13 because honestly, the most important thing of talking about love is to actually look at the narrative that defines what love is. That was in College Heights. College Heights sermon this past Sunday, Quadi brought this up, this very point. It goes back to what we've been talking about the whole time. The way in which, you want to know how a marriage relationship works? So whenever Mark 10:45 is the characterizing verse of your entire relationship, "I've not come to this marriage to be served, but to serve, and to give my life as a ransom for my wife." And if she has that same attitude, the marriage just flourishes. I mean, it is true. It's totally true. I've never had a conversation with my wife about who's in charge, about who's the authority. That honestly, for me, whenever I hear that, I'm like, oh, yeah, I mean, it's just kind of a silly question. Why? Because I'm working to serve her and she's working to serve me. People will say, what's some of the best advice you can give us as a couple? And I look at the man and I say, your job is to make all of the dreams of your wife, whatever she desires, it's your job to make them come true. And I look at the wife and I say, it's the same for you, except for him. That's your job. My job is to, and we did this early on. What is the things in your life that you're going, these are all the things I want to do. And we had different goals besides go to Disney World. Okay, well that just, I mean, I guess, but that's not really what we're talking about here. Like, my wife really wanted to be a nurse. And so I said, all right, well, we're going to do whatever that takes. Matter of fact, the only reason why in 3 weeks I'm completing my PhD is because of my wife. The only reason why. I actually, whenever I found out we were going to have to move over to Edinburgh for 3 months, I said, I'm not doing that. No, this degree is not worth that much. It just isn't to me. And my wife said, oh, no, we are doing that. No, we're moving over there. And she's like, I'm calling a realtor tomorrow. We're putting our house up for sale and we're moving. And I was like, oh gosh, like that, it kind of freaked me out. Why? Because she knew that was a dream. Her job is to make my dreams come true and my job is to make hers come true. That's just, where does that come from? Mark 10:45. If I come to a relationship and I'm not thinking who's in charge, but I come of how can I serve you? Honestly, the authority thing kind of takes care of itself. This reminds me of Philippians 2. You should have the attitude of Christ Jesus, who did not consider being God something to be grasped. But instead, he humbled himself, became flesh, even humbled himself to the point of death, even death on a cross. I mean, this goes back to what we've been talking about the whole time. You want to know how to do biblical justice or how to just live as a Christian? Do what Jesus did. Biblical justice is imitating Christ. Imitating Christ. Gender equality issues could be satisfied if women and men both came to look to serve the other. But we don't. We come to situations to be served. And any hint of us being the one that is not serving, but is being served, or any of us being the servant in the situation, we connote as weakness. We describe as losing on some level. Where Jesus says, it's not a matter of winning or losing. This is what it means to be what I am. Remember, I talked about last time how we're not just looking at what the identities are, or not even just the fact that he is king, but what type of king is he? And it's Mark's gospel actually begins by pronouncing an identity of Jesus. Very first verse. I actually think it's one of the most politically explosive verses in the entire Bible, Mark 1:1. The beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God. Very first verse. Mark says, my gospel is to tell you who he is. Who is he? He is the Christ, the Son of God. But there has to be at some point where you stop and say, but what kind of Christ? What kind of Son of God? At this point, multiple people have actually claimed both those titles. Matter of fact, in AD 6, Judas the Galilean comes and claims to be the Christ. He makes messianic claims. Jesus wasn't the first one to say, I am the Christ. He's not the first one. He won't even be the last. By the time we get to AD 66 and AD 70 when the temple's destroying, we have three people at once that are claiming to be the Messiah inside the city of Jerusalem. Inside the city of Jerusalem. So it's not like that claim in particular is what Mark's only point is. Question is, what type of Christ is he? What type of Christ? Or even Son of God. If I'm right, and the book of Mark is written in around 68 to 69, you're at a very unique time period in the history of the Roman Empire. Because for the first time in over 100 years, Roman blood is being spilled by Romans inside of the city of Rome. Civil war is just broken out. As a matter of fact, I was just reading this yesterday. I believe it is, I don't know if it's Suetonius, it might be Tacitus. He says that the secret was let out in 68 and 69, that the emperor of Rome could be made in other ways and in other places outside of Rome. That's the problem. Why is that dangerous? Because you have generals who are in charge of legions saying, now I'm the emperor, and then they march their legion on the city of Rome. And in the year of 69, this is real important, around the time when this was written, in the year of 69, there were four different emperors in 1 year. Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian. Four in 1 year. That's a problem. There's a bloody coup, and then one of them gets displaced. Galba gets displaced. Otho comes in, and then Vitellius, and then Vespasian. Four in 1 year. And guess what they all claim on their coins and in their language? Guess the title they all claim to be? Son of God. Why do they claim that? Well, that's what Augustus claimed back in 31. Back in 27, they said, we want to elevate you to God. And he says, no, you can't call me God, but you can call me Son of God, because Julius Caesar, my adopted dad, was a god. And from that point on, all the emperors claimed this title, Son of God. In 1 year, four of them in 69, around the time this was written, claimed to be Son of God. In the middle of that, Mark writes his gospel and says, actually, let me tell you about the true Son of God. This is the beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, to which I naturally ask, but what kind of Son of God? What type of Son of God? Is he the type of Son of God like the emperor, like Nero? What separates him from them? Matter of fact, what's interesting is Mark's gospel doesn't just begin by pronouncing Jesus the Son of God. It's also how it ends. It ends in Mark 15. Well, it bookends, I should say. In Mark 15, verse 39, we're at the foot of the cross. That may be an important element of this. Verse 37, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last breath. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And verse 39, and when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. Matter of fact, the Greek construction there is, it means this man as opposed to that man. Surely this man was the Son of God. One of the most clear, one of the most lucid proclamations of Jesus' identity in the entire book. As a matter of fact, what's interesting too is that one of the key motifs in the book of Mark is the messianic secret. What's the messianic secret? What is it? What is this feature? You guys ever heard of it? Messianic secret? No one knows what I'm talking about? Come on, Justin, tell me.
It's where Jesus doesn't allow people to say that he is the Christ or the Messiah.
It is a key literary motif in the book of Mark that William Redd in the late 1800s brings out and shows. In Mark's gospel, there is a consistent emphasis on saying, don't tell anyone who I am. Do not tell anyone who I am. As a matter of fact, you've seen in the very first chapter, you kind of get a little bit of this flavor. It's not exactly what we're looking for, but we'll get there in a minute. But right off the bat in 1:24 and 25, right after Jesus calls his first disciples, he announces the good news, then he drives out an impure spirit. But as he comes upon the spirit in verse 23, it says, just then a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an impure spirit cried out, what do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are. Identity language. The Holy One of God. What does Jesus say? Shut up. That's what he says. Be quiet. And he gets so stern with him, he just says, come out of him. Because he wants him just to shut up. Why? In Mark's gospel, Jesus is constantly saying, don't say who I am, even though you might be saying it very clearly. Matter of fact, you see this in the very next, at the end of the chapter, the very next page in my Bible, but the very end of the chapter, verses 40 through 45, Jesus heals a man with leprosy. The man comes up to Jesus, he says, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Jesus says, I am willing, be clean. Immediately, verse 42, the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning, a stern warning. What's the warning? Don't tell this to anyone. Go show yourself to the priest, offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for the cleansing of a testimony to them, but don't tell anyone. What does he do? Here, verse 45. Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. What's interesting in Mark's gospel is consistently there's this motif of don't tell anyone, and what do? They disobey and they go tell. He says, I don't want you to tell, and they say, we just can't help it, we're going to tell. We're going to tell. Go to the very end of the book of Mark. Very last couple of verses. Ooh, NIV 2011 actually does this pretty well. Okay, I don't say that often, so let's relish in the moment for a minute. Okay. At the very end, after verse 8, I don't know what it says in your Bible, but in my Bible it says, the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have verses 9 through 10. That's a bit weak, actually. It's the earliest and best manuscripts don't have verses 9 through 10. In my Bible, though, verses 9 through 10 is all in italics, which I think that's actually pretty good. Because the reality is, and I could give you all the evidence, but I don't have time for that, and frankly, that's not what this class is for. The earliest evidence and best evidence and even just the logic of why is it once we get down to verse 9, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven seven spirits. Why does he identify Mary Magdalene like that whenever he's already talked about her three times in the past chapter and a half? The earliest and best evidence and just some of the basic logic, the fact that there's like 21 new words, not just in the book of Matthew or Mark, but there's even like five of them that have never been used in the New Testament before in these 9 to 11 verses. All the evidence suggests that 9 through 20 probably was something that was added later. Don't freak out. It doesn't mean the resurrection isn't true. But here's what I want to ask you. What could possibly be being said if Mark's gospel ends in verse 8? Let's just act like the earliest manuscript, whenever Mark wrote his pen, with his pen, that he ends in verse 8, which says, trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. You know what's interesting about that to me? It is the very first time in verse 6 and 7, very first time, that people are commanded to go and tell the identity of Jesus. And what happens? In the Gospel of Mark, they don't tell. It's like the Messianic secret in reverse. They don't really see very clearly, and they're like, Jesus is like, don't tell anyone, and they're like, I don't care, I'm disobeying you, I'm going to go tell. And now they should see it very clearly. He has died and resurrected, and then they're told to go tell, and in the gospel, what do? They don't tell. There's in a sense where at the end of the Gospel of Mark, I almost feel like the finger's pointing out at the audience. It's saying, what if the women didn't go tell? They were commanded to go tell, and if they didn't, would you even know about this Jesus? And there's a part of it that you can almost hear him saying, now you were told to go tell, so what are you doing? Are you telling? If you're going to disobey Jesus, at least disobey him in a way that's constructive for the kingdom, where he tells you not to tell and you just can't help yourself and you tell. But instead, you've been told to tell, and I know things are a little weird right now in Rome, but you've been told to tell. And you're not. How does the story continue if you don't tell? But here's the kicker, though, of Mark's gospel. Here's the kicker. Tell them what? Tell them about who he is. But what type of Son of God is he? Notice the most clear revelation of Jesus. It's not just significant it comes from a centurion. It's significant that it comes from a centurion that is overwhelmed in the way in which he died. That's what it says in the text in 1539. After he saw the way in which he died, he said, surely this man is the Son of God. Why? Because it's not just a servant that we're getting here in Mark's gospel. It's not just another son of God. It's not just another king. It is one that serves through the cross, through being obedient, through even serving those that don't deserve to be served, even serving people to the point of death. That's the type of Son of God we have. He's a servant king. And that's what's interesting about Mark 10:45. Something we don't often talk about is the context of Mark 10:45. Mark 10:45 comes in a context where his disciples are fighting for power. They're fighting for the positions of prominence where they can be served. And that's even what you get with James and John. They come to Jesus, these little snakes. Teacher, we want you to do whatever you ask for us. Verse 35. Well, that's a bold request. Jesus is like, okay, well, what do you want me to do for you? I don't really know how to respond to that until you let me know exactly what it is you're asking. Oh, nothing big. Just let one of us, sit at your right hand and the other at your left when you come into your glory. What are they asking for? Power. Prestige. Honor. Positions of authority. Ones in which they are the rulers. Whenever you come into your glory, whenever you establish your kingdom, let one of us sit at the most prominent position, the right hand, and let the other one of us sit at the second most prominent position, your left. We want to consolidate the power. We'll be our own little triumvirate. Just you and us two. And we'll control all these other yahoos, other 9 include, other 11, or how do I add? 10 included. We'll take care of them. And this is what Jesus says. First of all, he says, you don't really know what you're asking for. And that phrase is actually should be understood in multiple ways. And he gives us one right away. I mean, can you really drink the cup I'm drinking and be baptized with the baptism I'm about to be baptized with? Oh yeah, we can, definitely. I don't think you understand. He says, oh, well, you know, you will drink the cup I drink, and you will be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. Which those are key symbols of suffering. Matter of fact, in just a bit, Jesus will pray in the Garden of Gethsemane, Father, take this cup away from me. This cup of what? Cup of suffering, of pain. Baptized with what? The Spirit? Actually, no, it's more along the lines of fire. I'm not talking about Pentecost. I'm talking about the pain and suffering that actually leads to death, and only a resurrection can cure it. He says, actually, you are going to be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with, and you'll drink the cup I'm going to drink with. It's just not exactly what you have in mind, because you don't know what you're asking. You don't get what you're asking. He goes on and he says, but to sit at my right and my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those whom they have been prepared. What's interesting is the right and the left, whenever Jesus comes into his glory, is whenever he's in the middle cross and he's had someone on his right and someone on his left. Again, he looks at him and says, you just don't know what you're asking for. Because you don't even know what my glory looks like. You think you know what my glory looks like. You think it looks like the Rome. Actually, the only one that's going to clearly know what my glory looks like when it is happening is a centurion. Because whenever I come into my glory, he's the one that says, surely this man is the Son of God. Surely. When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Naturally, that's a jerk thing to do. I actually think that if I'm going to recreate this, I think Peter's probably the most upset. Why? He's one third of the inner three. And two thirds of the inner three go and snake these positions from behind his back. Hey, when we come to glory, let's get us to it. Because I mean, Peter, really, honestly, the guy's a dullard. Just two chapters earlier, Jesus, you had to call him Satan and say, get behind me. Not a good candidate to run this place. So why don't you just make it James and John? James and John. Jesus looks at him and he says, now notice how the context flows into verse 45. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. What's he doing? What's he doing? He's describing what type of son of God he is. He's saying, now let's look at the kings of the earth. How do they rule? They rule and they exercise authority. They lord it over them. But that's the Gentile kings. That's not who I am, and that's not who you should be. He says, no. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. You're looking at the ways of the world and say, I want to rule and reign and have power like this. But that's not the type of kingdom, that's not the type of king that I am. No. Whoever wants to be first in my kingdom must be slave of all. Why? For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. It's not just who am I, but what type of king am I? What type of Son of God am I? What type of Christ am I? And that's why you cannot understand the Christ without the cross. That's what Mark's gospel is crying out. That's the reason why I think that even Richard Hayes is right. That explains the messianic secret. No, you don't just get to yell out my name. Because the moment that you do and you don't add the cross in the equation is the moment you actually get me entirely wrong, even though you're saying the right names. So shut your mouth. Wait until the moment becomes clear when you see what my glory is, when it defines who I am. And at that moment, scream it from the rooftops. It's not just about telling people who Jesus is. It's about making sure you tell them who the right person, or what the right type of identity he is. You cannot have a Christ without a cross, no matter how much that you desire it. No matter how much Jesus desires it. He does. A Christ without the cross is not the Christ of Jesus. It's not the right Son of God. For our Christ, our victory, our kingdom is defined by a king that was servant to all. And you hear again ringing, how much more? How much more? If Christ is a servant of all, and that's the type of king he is, then what type of soldier in the kingdom ought you to be? It kind of reminds me of the question, if you do these actions, who will you become? Who will you become? See, getting the right type of king Jesus is really important because that can really shape your entire identity. I might get really nervous whenever people talk about Jesus in this lovey-dovey, really non-confrontational type picture, this Mr. Rogers, Barney on steroids, just loving everybody. Well, that's not exactly the only type of one he is, because man, my goodness, I don't think the Pharisees and Sadducees would say, man, he's just flowers and puppies. At the same time, I get really worried whenever people paint Jesus in this warmongering, really looking forward to coming back on a white horse and wiping out people with a sword. Although if you read that text, it's actually pretty not violent. But that's okay. People would just like to make Jesus into their own image. Make sure you understand what type of king he is. Because one of the very levels of heresy and blasphemy is portraying Jesus in a way in which he is not, changing his identity. Let him be what he wants to be. And this is what I clearly hear him saying that he wants to be. I am a king that is not like any other king of the world. For I reign, I rule, I have victory whenever people destroy me, whenever I serve. That's how we win. And if you change this, which is the cross, the Christ without a cross, then you cannot be my disciple. You are on the side of the enemy. This is the very issue in Mark chapter 8. When Peter rebukes Jesus. Over what? Because he was wanting to be a Christ with the cross. And Jesus says, you are Satan if you deny the cross. Because that changes my very identity. No, I am a king that has come to serve. And that's how we win. And if you don't like it, you don't have to be a part of this kingdom. You see what he's saying? Does that make sense on some level? We'll see what Mark has to say about it tomorrow. Love you guys. Luke. Love you guys. See you in the morning.